A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's pointing to the extreme UV index Israel recorded yesterday, an 11 plus, while the temperature was only 28 degrees. He's asking what the UV index actually measures, why it doesn't track with temperature, whether its main job is just telling you how much sunscreen to wear, and how it gets measured and forecast. It's a good question, because that disconnect between a scorching UV reading and a perfectly pleasant afternoon is genuinely counterintuitive.
It catches people off guard every year. You step outside, it feels mild, you skip the sunscreen, and by evening you look like a cooked lobster. The Israeli Meteorological Service clocked 11.3 at 12:30 p.m. yesterday in Tel Aviv. 28 degrees, light breeze, beautiful day, and the ultraviolet radiation was brutal.
What exactly is the UV index measuring, and why did Israel see an 11 while the thermometer barely hit 28?
Let's start with what the index actually is. It's a numerical scale, 0 to 11 plus, created in 1995 by the World Health Organization, the World Meteorological Organization, the UN Environment Program, and the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection. It was standardized globally by the WHO in 2002, and what it measures is ground-level solar ultraviolet radiation, but weighted in a very specific way, by something called the CIE erythemal action spectrum.
That's the reddening of skin, the burn.
The index isn't measuring total UV energy hitting the ground. It's measuring how quickly fair skin will burn. It's a biologically weighted measure of skin damaging potential, not a physical measure of total radiation. Think of it as a burn speed meter rather than a light meter.
It's not a raw physics reading. It's physics filtered through a very specific biological question. How fast does this particular type of skin fry?
That's the key insight, and the weighting matters enormously. Ultraviolet radiation comes in two main bands that reach the surface. UVB, which is 280 to 315 nanometers, and UVA, 315 to 400 nanometers. UVA is much more abundant in sunlight, roughly 20 times more photons, but UVB is about 1,000 times more erythemally effective per photon, so the index heavily weights UVB even though there's less of it. The CIE action spectrum peaks at 298 nanometers right in the UVB range, and by the time you get to 330 nanometers, the effectiveness has dropped by a factor of 1,000.
Which means the index is basically a UVB detector with some UVA, thrown in for completeness.
It's a UVB-weighted composite, and that's the first piece of the puzzle for why UV and temperature diverge. UVB reaching the surface depends on solar elevation angle, how high the sun is in the sky, which is determined by time of day, latitude, and season. It also depends on ozone column thickness, cloud cover, altitude, and surface albedo. None of those are air temperature.
Walk me through the Israel case specifically.
Israel sits at about 32 degrees north. In late May, solar noon elevation is roughly 81 degrees. The sun is nearly directly overhead. The ozone column over Israel this time of year averages 280 to 300 Dobson units, which is relatively thin compared to about 350 over the tropics. Thin ozone means less UVB absorption in the stratosphere, so more reaches the surface. Add clear skies, dry air with low aerosol loading, and you get extreme UV. The air temperature is moderated by the Mediterranean breeze, but the UV doesn't care about breezes.
The sun angle and the ozone are doing the heavy lifting, and the temperature is off doing its own thing.
Temperature at the surface is driven by infrared radiation from the sun heating the ground, which then heats the air. UV is a tiny fraction of total solar energy, less than 10% of the sun's output, and it doesn't heat the air efficiently. You can have a clear, cool day at high altitude where UV is extreme but the air is thin and cold. Denver, Colorado, sitting at 1600 meters, can register a UV index of 10 while the air temperature is 15 degrees Celsius. Meanwhile, Miami on a hazy summer day at 35 degrees might only show a UV index of 7 because of high humidity, aerosol scattering, and a thicker effective atmospheric path.
The Denver versus Miami comparison is the kind of thing that makes people's brains short-circuit if they've always assumed hot equals Bernie.
It gets more extreme. There's a 2022 study from the Dead Sea, specifically at Ain Bokeh. They recorded a UV index of 14. The Dead Sea sits at 430 meters below sea level, the lowest land point on Earth. You've got extra atmospheric column below you that's denser, plus the salt flats have extremely high albedo, reflecting UV back up and effectively doubling the exposure. The air temperature might be 40 degrees, but the UV is off the charts for reasons that have nothing to do with the heat.
That's above the scale they designed.
The scale tops out at 11 plus, labeled extreme. Above 11, unprotected fair skin burns in less than 10 minutes. At 14, you're looking at more like 7 or 8 minutes. The scale wasn't designed to cap at 11 because UV stops there. It's because at the time of standardization, values above 11 were considered rare enough that a single catch-all category sufficed. That's changing.
We've established that UV and temperature are independent variables. Now let's talk about how the measurement actually works. What's the instrument?
Ground stations use spectroradiometers. These are precision instruments that measure spectral irradiance across the UV band. Essentially, how much energy is arriving at each wavelength from 280 to 400 nanometers. They scan through the spectrum, and the raw data is then multiplied by the CIE erythemal weighting function at each wavelength. The weighted irradiance values are integrated across the UV band to get a single number in watts per square meter. That number is multiplied by 40 to convert it to the UV index scale.
Multiply by 40.
It's a scaling convention. A UV index of 1 corresponds to 25 milliwatts per square meter of erythemally weighted UV. The factor of 40 converts from watts per square meter to the dimensionless index number. It's arbitrary but convenient. It makes the numbers land in a range that's easy for the public to understand.
The raw reading is a physical measurement, watts per square meter, and then it gets run through a biological weighting function and a scaling factor to produce something a weather presenter can say in 5 seconds.
That's the entire public health communication pipeline in one sentence. The McKinley-Diffie Erythema Action Spectrum, published in 1987, is the specific weighting function used. It was derived from studies on fair-skinned subjects, primarily Fitzpatrick skin types 1 and 2, and that's one of the index's major blind spots. It assumes fair skin. If you have darker skin, the index overstates your personal burn risk. Fitzpatrick type 5 or 6 skin might tolerate UV index 11 for much longer than 10 minutes without burning.
Which creates an equity problem in public health messaging. Everyone hears the same number, but the number means different things to different people.
The WHO acknowledges this. The index is designed as a population-level tool, not a personal dosimeter. It tells you the environmental hazard level. What your skin does with that hazard depends on your individual melanin concentration, which the index doesn't know and can't account for.
Like a weather report that tells you it's raining, without asking if you're holding an umbrella.
Now, measurement is one thing, forecasting is another. How do you predict the UV index days in advance?
That's the second part of the question, and I'm guessing it's not just sticking a thermometer into the future.
Far from it. UV index forecasting requires numerical weather prediction models, the same kind that predict temperature and precipitation, but they need to output additional variables, specifically ozone column thickness, cloud optical depth, and aerosol optical depth. Those three inputs feed into radiative transfer models. Software packages like TUV, which stands for Tropospheric Ultraviolet Invisible, or LibRadTran, that compute spectral irradiance at the surface given the atmospheric state.
The weather model says here's what the atmosphere will look like tomorrow. Ozone amount, cloud cover, haze, and then a separate radiation model calculates what UV that atmosphere lets through.
That's the pipeline. The European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts, the ECMWF, runs its integrated forecasting system, which predicts total ozone column from satellite data assimilation and atmospheric chemistry. The Global Forecast System, the American GFS, does the same. Those outputs get fed into radiative transfer codes that compute the UV spectrum at ground level, apply the aerothermal weighting, multiply by 40, and produce the forecast index.
How far out can they forecast?
Typically, out to 5 days with reasonable skill. Ozone is relatively predictable on short timescales because it's a large-scale stratospheric field. Cloud cover is the biggest source of forecast error. Get the clouds wrong by 20%, and your UV forecast can be off by a similar margin. Aerosols are even trickier. Dust storms, wildfire smoke, volcanic eruptions, these can slash UV at the surface, but they're hard to predict more than a day or two out.
There's a fascinating failure mode you mentioned in your notes. A study from Tel Aviv University about dust storms and UV underprediction.
Yes, a 2025 study from Tel Aviv University found that UV index forecasts underpredicted extreme events by about 30% during dust storm conditions. The counterintuitive part is why. Dust aerosols scatter UV radiation. Some get scattered back to space, which reduces direct UV. But some get scattered forward, and when you have broken clouds interacting with dust, you can get what's called cloud enhancement, UV radiation bouncing off cloud edges and concentrating in certain areas. The forecast models assumed dust would reduce UV, but the scattering geometry actually amplified it in some locations.
That's the phenomenon where broken clouds can increase UV by up to 25% compared to clear sky.
Most people assume clouds block UV. Thick overcast does. It can cut UV by 50% or more. But scattered cumulus clouds on an otherwise sunny day can act like lenses and mirrors, focusing additional UV onto the surface. You can get burned faster on a partly cloudy day than on a completely clear one. The Australian Bureau of Meteorology explicitly warns about this in their UV alert system.
That's the kind of thing that makes forecasting hard. It's not just a matter of running the model at higher resolution. You need to capture three-dimensional cloud structure in real time.
The operational systems handle this differently. The US EPI's UV index forecast uses the National Weather Service's National Air Quality Forecasting Capability, the NAQFC model, with 1 hour temporal resolution. Europe uses the Copernicus Atmosphere Monitoring Service, CAMS, for ozone and aerosol data. Australia runs its own system through the Bureau of Meteorology, and they're particularly aggressive about public communication. Their UV alert system triggers at index 3, which is labeled moderate, while the US EPI triggers at 6, which is high.
3 versus 6. That's a significant philosophical difference about when to start warning people.
It reflects different national experiences with skin cancer. Australia has the highest melanoma rates in the world. Their public health campaigns. Slip, Slop, Slap, which started in the 80s, are built around the idea that UV exposure is cumulative and dangerous even at moderate levels. The U.S. approach has historically been more reactive. Warn when it's high, assume people will figure out the rest. But even at UV index 3, fair skin can burn in about 30 minutes without protection.
That's one of the misconceptions you wanted to bust. The idea that you only need sunscreen when the index is high or above.
It's pervasive. People look at the number and think, moderate means negligible. Moderate means you'll burn in 30 to 45 minutes if you're fair-skinned. That's a lunch break. That's walking the dog. The cumulative DNA damage from repeated moderate exposure is a significant driver of skin cancer risk, even if you never get a visible sunburn.
The index isn't just a sunscreen guide, but it gets used as one because that's the simplest mental model. What else should people be using it for?
The most underutilized application is timing. The UV index follows a predictable diurnal curve. It peaks at solar noon and drops off sharply in the early morning and late afternoon. A good rule of thumb is that when your shadow is shorter than you are, UV is high. But the index gives you precision. Below 3, which typically occurs before 10 a.m. and after 4 p.m. in mid-latitude summer, you can be outside with minimal protection. Above 6, you want to minimize exposure between 10 and 4. Above 11, the advice is basically, stay indoors during peak hours.
That's actionable regardless of skin type. Even if you don't burn easily, UVA penetrates deeper and drives photoaging and cumulative DNA damage.
UVA is the silent actor here. It doesn't cause immediate reddening the way UVB does, so people don't feel it happening. But it penetrates to the dermis, breaks down collagen, generates free radicals, and contributes to melanoma risk. The UV index waits. UVA very lightly because the erythemal action spectrum is built around acute burning, not long-term damage. So the index is actually undercounting the total biological hazard if you care about aging and cumulative exposure.
The index was designed for one specific question, how fast do I burn? And it answers that well. But it's being asked to do more work than it was built for.
That's the story of every public health metric ever created. They get adopted, they become familiar, and then people start using them as a general wellness score without understanding the narrowness of the original design.
Let's talk about some of the emerging alternatives. Personal UV dosimeters, smartphone sensors.
This is where things get interesting. The UV index is a population-level environmental hazard measure. It tells you what's happening in the air around you. But what actually matters for your health is your personal accumulated dose, how much UV reached your skin over the course of a day. Wearable UV sensors like the shade sensor, UV band, and even some smartwatches now measure actual exposure in real time. They integrate over time and can alert you when you've hit a threshold.
Instead of looking at a forecast and guessing, you get a buzz on your wrist that says you've had enough.
It accounts for the things the UV index can't. Whether you were in shade, whether you were wearing a hat, whether you were near reflective surfaces. A UV index of 11 means something very different if you're sitting under an umbrella versus standing on a white sand beach. The personal dosimeter measures what actually reached you.
Which seems like the obvious next step for public health, shifting from population-level hazard warnings to individual-level dose management.
The challenge is adoption and cost. The EPA's Sunwise app and the WHO's Global Solar UV Index app are free and give you the forecast for your location. That's accessible to anyone with a smartphone. Wearable dosimeters cost money and require people to actually wear them, but the accuracy improvement is substantial. A 2023 study showed that personal UV monitors reduced sunburn incidence by about 35% in a trial of Australian outdoor workers compared to those who only had access to the public UV index forecast.
35% is enormous for a behavioral intervention.
It's because the feedback is immediate and personal. The UV index is abstract. It's a number on a screen that you have to translate into behavior. The dosimeter says you specifically have had enough. That closes the intention. Action gap.
What about the forecasting side? Are there AI-based approaches that improve on the traditional radiative transfer pipeline?
There's been a significant shift in the last few years. Traditional radiative transfer models like TUV and LibRadTran are computationally expensive. They solve the radiative transfer equation through the atmosphere layer by layer, which takes time. Machine learning models are now being trained to emulate these radiative transfer codes. You train a neural network on millions of TUV model runs with varying inputs, ozone, clouds, aerosols, solar angle, and it learns to predict the UV index directly from atmospheric parameters without solving the physics.
It's a physics emulator. Faster, cheaper, slightly less accurate in edge cases.
The trade-off is exactly that. The ECMWF has been experimenting with neural network emulators for UV forecasting, and they can produce forecasts in milliseconds that would take minutes with full radiative transfer. The accuracy is within a few percent for typical conditions. The edge cases, cloud enhancement events, heavy aerosol loading, unusual ozone profiles, those still benefit from full physics. But for everyday operational forecasting, the emulators are good enough and getting better.
Which means we're heading toward a world where your phone gets a hyperlocal UV forecast every 15 minutes based on real-time satellite cloud data and an AI model running on a server somewhere.
Combined with personal exposure history from wearables, you could get individualized risk assessment. The next generation of UV forecasting will likely integrate personal exposure data, shifting from population level to individual level risk. Imagine an app that knows your skin type, your location history, your cumulative UV dose this week, and tells you whether today's forecast means you should adjust your plans.
That's the dream. Now, given all this, what should someone actually do with a UV index number?
First, check UV alongside temperature. Treat them as independent variables. A cool day can still fry you. Second, use the index as a timing tool. If the forecast shows UV peaking above 6 between 10 and 4, schedule outdoor activities outside that window. Below 3, you're generally fine without protection for reasonable periods. Above 8, minimize exposure during peak hours, and if you have to be out, cover up. Third, for listeners in high UV regions, Australia, the Middle East, the Andes, high altitude locations, consider a personal UV monitor, especially if you have children or you work outdoors.
What should people download?
The EPI's Sunwise app for the United States, the WHO's Global Solar UV Index app for international coverage, and the Australian Bureau of Meteorology's SunSmart app if you're in Australia. All three give location-based UV forecasts with hourly breakdowns. The key numbers to remember. Extreme, 11+, means unprotected skin burns in less than 10 minutes. Very high, 8 to 10, burns in about 15 to 25 minutes. High, 6 to 7, about 30 minutes. Moderate, 3 to 5, about 30 to 45 minutes. And low, 0 to 2, you've got an hour or more.
Those burn times are for fair skin. Fitzpatrick type 2. If you have darker skin, your burn threshold is higher, but the cumulative damage from UVA is still happening.
That's the nuance the index doesn't capture. It's a starting point, not the whole story.
One more thing I want to touch on, the climate angle. As ozone recovery progresses and cloud patterns shift, are extreme UV events going to become more frequent in mid-latitudes?
That's an open question and an active area of research. The Montreal Protocol successfully phased out ozone-depleting substances, and the ozone layer is slowly recovering. We're on track for a return to 1980 levels by around 2060 to 2070 in mid-latitudes. That recovery should reduce baseline UV. But climate change is altering cloud cover patterns in complex ways. Some regions are seeing more clear sky days, which would increase surface UV. Others are seeing more convective cloudiness, which could increase cloud enhancement events. Those broken cloud situations where UV actually spikes above clear sky levels.
The net effect isn't obvious. Ozone recovery pushes UV down, cloud changes could push it up, and the regional variation is enormous.
There's a third factor. Aerosol changes. As countries reduce air pollution, aerosol loading decreases, which means less UV scattering and higher surface UV. China saw this effect during COVID lockdowns. Reduced industrial aerosols led to measurable increases in surface UV in some regions. Cleaner air is better for lungs, but potentially worse for skin, at least in the short term.
The world never lets you have a simple win.
It really doesn't.
Before we wrap, I want to zoom out for a second. The UV Index was designed in 1995 as a public health communication tool. It's simple, it's standardized, it's globally adopted. But it was built around a specific biological model, fair skin burning, that doesn't represent most of the world's population. As we move toward personalized exposure monitoring, is the UV index going to become obsolete?
I don't think obsolete. I think it'll become the background layer, the environmental hazard baseline that everyone can access for free, while personal dosimetry becomes the premium layer for people who want optimization. The UV index is like the public weather forecast. Personal dosimeters are like having a weather station in your backyard. Both have value, they serve different needs, and they complement each other.
The forecast models will keep improving regardless. AI emulators will make UV prediction cheaper and faster. Satellite constellations will provide better real-time cloud and aerosol data, and the whole system will get more accurate.
The direction of travel is clear. More personal, more real-time, more integrated with behavior. But the core insight of the UV index, that UV and temperature are independent hazards, is something that still hasn't fully penetrated public consciousness. Yesterday in Tel Aviv, 28 degrees and UV 11+. Somebody looked at that mild, beautiful day and thought, I don't need protection, and they were wrong.
That's the value of understanding the metric. It's not just a number to glance at. It's a warning system for a hazard you can't feel.
You can't feel UV until hours later when the damage is already done. That's what makes it uniquely dangerous among environmental exposures. Heat, cold, wind, you feel those immediately and adjust. UV is invisible and silent, and by the time your body signals the problem, the DNA damage has already occurred.
The UV index is essentially a prosthetic for a sense humans never evolved.
That's a beautiful way to put it. We evolved to detect infrared as heat. We never evolved a UV sensor in our skin that gives real-time feedback, just a delayed pain response that kicks in after the damage is done. The UV index, and now personal dosimeters, are technologies that fill that evolutionary gap.
which makes it more than a sunscreen guide. It's a sensory augmentation tool.
That framing changes how you use it. It's not just about whether to apply SPF 30 or 50. It's about knowing something about your environment that your body literally cannot tell you. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late 1600s, Spanish explorers in Honduras reported a lava tube cave where bats had apparently developed a cooperative hunting strategy. They would fan out across the tube ceiling in a grid pattern and take turns diving through insect swarms, rotating positions every few minutes as if working shifts. The behavior has never been documented in any other bat population before or since.
Cooperative hunting bats with shift schedules. One forward-looking thought before we go. The next frontier for UV research is integrating personal exposure data with AI-driven skin cancer risk prediction. We've covered what the UV index measures and how it's forecast. Next time, we'll look at how machine learning models are starting to predict individual melanoma risk from cumulative UV exposure history, combining wearable data, genetic markers, and imaging. That's where this is all heading.
It'll change how we think about sun protection from a generic warning to a personalized risk management tool.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you haven't already, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.